the Dot. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist reporting for different outlets, including Alternet, Truth Out, Truthdig, The Huffington Post, and Tom Dispatch. And we do this show, it's going into its eighth year here on Progressive Radio, to connect the dots between what's going on in our lives, our communities, and our society. And each week on the show, we feature different thought leaders, experts, advocates, journalists, authors, discussing different facets of things that we need to know about in our interconnected world. On today's show, I'm really delighted to have an absolutely terrific guest speaking with us live about an incredibly timely topic, namely the hearings for the proposed nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. Some of you will have been following that, some not. We're going to try to give an overview today as well as get into some of the weeds and so that you'll come away with a really complete picture. My guest today is Lisa Graves, and we really couldn't have a more knowledgeable expert about this topic. Lisa has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government and other leadership posts. As the president of the board of the Center for Media and Democracy and co-founder of Documented Investigations, Lisa has in the past served at the level of Deputy Assistant Attorney General at the U.S. Department of Justice. She worked in the Office of Legal Policy and Policy Development. She had also served as Chief Counsel for Nominations for the U.S. Judiciary Committee for Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont. She's also worked as Deputy Chief of the U.S. Court System, as an adjunct law professor, and as a leading legislative strategist. We really couldn't have a more expert witness to analyze the process, the policies, and what's at stake in the Brett Kavanaugh nomination. And, you know, that's why those of you who watch television will also have seen her making frequent recent appearances on MSNBC, and she's also been with her colleagues contributing several very important key articles, the substance of which we'll be discussing on today's show. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Lisa Graves. So happy to have you with us.
Hi, Allison. Thank you so much for inviting me on. I appreciate it.
We're going to be able to do something, kind of a broad sweep here, because we have, 58 minutes to talk, and that is to give people an overview. You've been speaking extensively, with each kind of curve of the news cycle, each new piece of information and step in the process of what's happening, but this is an opportunity to kind of really look at the entire trajectory so that people can listen to this program and share it and really orient themselves and each other if they have not been following it as closely as some of us have. So let's plunge right in. I want to ask you, before we begin with the process and where we are now with this nomination, what's at stake with the proposed Brett Kavanaugh nomination?
Well, this is perhaps the most significant Supreme Court nomination or vacancy, really, in this generation. I say that because I know there's political rhetoric over time that people hear those things. This is a situation in which, just on the seat itself, sort of setting aside Brett Kavanaugh's background and more, but just in terms of the U.S. Supreme Court, President Bush was able to put two justices on that court. They're very right-wing. That's Justice Roberts and Justice Alito. Clarence Thomas, who was nominated when he was very young in 1991, is still on the U.S. Supreme Court, and he could serve for another 10 or 20 years, perhaps 20 years. And then President Trump has secured the confirmation of Neil Gorsuch to that court. That's the four members right now on the right wing of that court. And there's a vacancy on the court because of the retirement of Justice Anthony Kennedy, who has been a longtime member of the sort of right wing of that court. He was nominated by President Reagan, but he was the swing vote in some significant issues, including the issue of privacy, you know, sexual privacy and autonomy, particularly in issues involving the rights of gay, lesbian, GLBT Americans to not be discriminated against. And so Kennedy's retirement really opens up that court potentially to have a five-person majority for the next perhaps 20 years. And possibly more if other justices were to retire or leave their seat from the not right wing side, the moderate to progressive side of that court. And so this is the balance of the court for a generation of all of us, at all of our ages. And this majority, the four members in the majority right now, have already signaled their extreme willingness to reverse decades of precedent. They did that this summer when they issued the ruling in the case called Janus, which involved the rights of for collective bargaining, and changed the rules that had been in place for decades, going back to the 1970s, disregarded basically years of precedent regarding how unions work and whether they represent all of the workforce where they are organizing or not. And the court basically reached back to, that was with Justice Kennedy on board, but it reached back to the wish list of some of these right-wing families in this country, including the Koch family, the billionaire Koch brothers, their father's agenda to push what they call so-called right-to-work laws nationally. That was an issue in the 1950s, a sort of union-busting tactic that emerged after World War II, was embraced predominantly in southern states to try to block organizing by African-Americans in the workforce, but also labor more generally. It was adopted in a couple of states. It was not the national rule. It was not the norm. But this Supreme Court just this summer reversed decades of precedent to basically roll the clock back to an earlier period in terms of really weakening union rights, the rights of working people in this country. And that's not all. That court, five members of that court, with Justice Kennedy, issued the ruling in Citizens United back in 2010 that has unleashed this wave of dark money, money that is not disclosed in terms of who gave the money, but money which is dwarfing the disclosed money in our elections, and really drowning out the voices of ordinary voters, and letting these enormously rich and powerful CEOs and corporations have tremendous influence on our election. And there's more on choice, on the environment, on whether Roe will continue to be precedent or not in terms of women's reproductive rights, whether we'll have protections for birth control, whether those will be constitutionally protected as part of the fundamental privacy rights of Americans, whether the government will be able to pursue efforts to protect and protect our environment and mitigate the climate changes that are underway, or whether there'll be a majority on that court to strike down environmental legislation or legislation to address climate change. So while Justice Kennedy was no vanguard of moderation, he certainly joined in a number of extremely right-wing activists, what would be called activist decisions. He was older, and his tenure was coming to an end on the court during whoever won this presidency. And now this vacancy has arisen, and it gives the right wing, the corporate right wing in this country, and the Koch brothers, who have been seeking to control this court, an opportunity to control it for 20 or 30 years into the future. Sorry for that long answer, but that's the context.
No, thank you. It's an excellent answer. And, you know, this particular 20-year period, as we're having under this current administration, you know, regulatory takedowns in every direction, multiple threats to civil liberties, to equity, to economic viability, and to the environment, you know, a lot of irreparable damage is being done today even without this. And, you know, 20 years of not having the recourse of, you know, the third branch of government, the court system, the judicial system, you know, is quite, I mean, there's no overstating the seriousness of it. You know, even before the recent allegations, which we'll get to, you know, a little bit further on in the show, from your experience with the judicial system as a direct staffer for the Judicial Committee, and from your exchanges and conversations with, you know, your other colleagues, people who've served and been watchdogs on this system, could you describe for our listeners prior to these allegations any anomalies that, you know, you and others have observed in the process of this nomination and hearing?
Well, you know, I appreciate that question. I did want to put the vacancy in context, why it's important, and why it's important for there to be a fair judge in that post. I just want to, if I could, Allison, talk a little bit about
sure.
that, because I think it's important because it bears on what we're going to talk about next, which is this is obviously the nation's highest court. There are 9 members of that court. It's the most prestigious post a judge could possibly have in our country. It's a post with extremely weighty responsibilities to interpret the law, to interpret the Constitution in cases that affect you know, more than 100 million people, hundreds of millions of people in this country, and even globally, depending on the types of cases that the court takes. The court is a court that there have been really hard-fought battles over for a couple of decades going now, and that context is important for a couple reasons I'll share from my perspective. You know, the courts were not always the Supreme Court was not always fought over in this particular way. The courts, in some ways, for much of its history, the U.S. Supreme Court was in many ways very pro corporation and had gone out of its way to not read the Constitution to protect people's rights. So, for example, after the Civil War and the Civil War amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th amendments that were intended to protect the rights of newly freed slaves in this country, the U.S. Supreme Court failed to enforce those amendments and instead constructed some rights for corporations to use those equal protection laws or due process laws that were embodied in the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendment, and it failed to protect people from baseline violations of civil rights. The U.S. Supreme Court had allowed the practices of the South in terms of what was known as the Jim Crow laws to become the law of the land, to allow racial segregation that was manifestly unfair and discriminatory to be enforced. And they did so for nearly a decade. During that period, they also struck down legislation after legislation coming out of New York State and other states that were passed by strong majorities, Democratic majorities in essence, and progressive Republicans that were calling for protections for workers, limits on how long a work day could be, overtime rules, limits on child labor, protections for the safety in a workplace, for example, after the Triangle Fire tragedy in New York City. There were numerous measures that that people were clamoring for in the industrial age to have their rights protected and to have the law protect them from employers who were exerting, you know, extreme practices in the workplace and more. And the court was striking down those provisions. It was called the Lochner era in the legal language of the time, And it didn't change until right in the middle of the Great Depression in the 1930s, when President Roosevelt, so frustrated that the New Deal was being blocked by this very activist right-wing court, proposed expanding the number of judges on that court in order to deal with this usurpation of democratic authority. And only then did the court step back and allow those New Deal laws to go forward. And then subsequently, President Eisenhower actually appointed a man named Earl Warren to the U.S. Supreme Court. He'd been the governor of California. He was a Republican. He actually had been a prosecutor in San Diego area. He had, as governor of California, he had presided over the internment of Japanese citizens. He was not sort of known as a progressive leader. He was a Republican leader of California. He had been he had actually been Eisenhower's rival for the presidency, and in essence, appointing Supreme Court was a way to get him off of that political rivalry and onto the court with his legal background. And Warren coming to the U.S. Supreme Court dramatically changed America. The right wing says he changed it by being an activist. I think he changed it by actually reading the Constitution as it says. And so when Earl Warren got to the court, by then, with the tremendous legal legal talents, the determination, the strategic genius of Thurgood Marshall, the U.S. Supreme Court finally reversed decades of precedent on segregation and issued the landmark case of Brown versus Board of Education, which declared declared a segregation in our public schools to be unconstitutional and set the groundwork for an expansion of rights through the legislature and an infusion of protection for the rights embodied in the Constitution through that Warren Court. So the Warren Court from the early 1950s through the 1960s issued decision after decision that actually said that the words of the Constitution meant what they said, that there would be equal protection of the laws, that voting rights would be protected, the voting rights that are guaranteed by the Constitution, that when the Constitution says that you have a right to counsel, it means you have a right to counsel, that the Fourth Amendment means something, that the, that you have rights against unreasonable searches and seizures, that there would be warrants required in criminal cases, for example. And that those rulings were issued by a range of justices, nine justices on that court, who were not chosen to advance an ideological agenda. They were chosen for a variety of reasons based on their legal background, legal expertise, reputation in their communities. And that court, I think, actually gave real life to our Constitution in terms of enforcing the words that were written for us to guide our nation. And the right-wing reaction to that was extreme. They made a determination to try to reverse the Warren Court, to put judges on, in the words of Nixon, who were law and order judges. In the words of Reagan, he was going to put pro-life judges on to reverse Roe. He had a litmus test. He was he had Ed Meese at the Justice Department trying to find, you know, right-wing judges who were going to basically reverse the U.S. Supreme Court, who had an agenda. Bush continued that in his appointments. George Herbert Walker Bush in Clarence Thomas, for example, and George W. Bush continued that. And so you've had this effort to try to repudiate these Warren Court decisions and the Burger Court decision that came after that, including Roe in the early 1970s, this decision to reverse those precedents. So this current moment in terms of who's on the court, why they're chosen, how they got there, you know, this battle in many ways is not about Brett Kavanaugh. It's not about Justice Kennedy. It's about whether our constitutional rights are going to be enforced or whether people who are chosen to eliminate those rights, restrict those rights, are being rewarded with judgeships in order to do just that. And the reason it's so important at the most baseline is because the most fundamental characteristic for a judge is that they be fair, that you believe if you have a case that goes before them, they will fairly hear you. They will fairly assess the law and the facts. They will be honest about the law and the facts, and they will not, the decision is basically pre-made before your case even arrives. But what the Republicans have wanted, what they've wanted since Nixon, through Reagan, through Bush and now Trump, What the Kochs have wanted is a sure thing, a sure bet, a guarantee that they were going to get what they want out of the Supreme Court. And so that is turning that court into an arm of that political party, of that ideological strain, in order to basically advance the agenda of that party and the funders of that party in ways that are extremely detrimental to the rights and interests of ordinary Americans.
That sounds terrible. And so, you know, what you're saying is, you know, we're focusing on Kavanaugh, he's the man, but the background agenda for all of this has the same power that came in through, you know, with even more, you know, force and capacity through the Citizens United decision. So, you know, many liberals and progressives would like to see reversal of Citizens United so that the government is restored to integrity and we don't have people in government whose allegiance goes to donors in order to keep their, you know, position in government, not to the people. And this is actually almost like a long-term, you know, lock-in override on automatic pilot that would make it exceedingly difficult, not to say impossible, to reverse the incredibly difficult trends we've already seen and which are already affecting the democracy, the economy, our lives, the environment. You know, what has given the, you know, the kind of power behind the throne whose agenda nominating Brett Kavanaugh is, what has the actual process of his vetting been? Has it been along the lines that would assure, as you're saying, a fair judge or even a normal process of assessment?
Well, no, and I really appreciate you pointing out the Citizens United component of this because that case is one where the hubris, the arrogance of that case is extraordinary. You know, you have a situation there where the U.S. Supreme Court is saying that Congress cannot pass a law restricting, even requiring basically disclosure 60 days before an election of who's funding these attack ads. That the First Amendment, that this new interpretation of the First Amendment gives rights to these corporations, to basically spend unlimited money undisclosed to you, before the election to influence your vote. And that this is supposedly a fundamental First Amendment right, that money is speech, expanding on that idea, and that money is speech then cannot be restricted by we the people in our democracy trying to protect our democracy, our political branches from this manifest corruption. Then the court has defined corruption very narrowly. And in that decision, Kennedy suggested that perhaps there could be some disclosure, but in fact, Congress has failed to pass any disclosure, and it struck down rules that required just that kind of disclosure. But as you point out, this question of, you know, why is this happening? Was there vetting? Was there normal vetting? I would say the answer to that is no. This is a situation in which Trump, by his own words, to the extent that you can trust his words, but he said he was basically outsourcing this to the Federal Society, the selection, the list, the creation of the list, the Federal Society. The Federal Society was created in the early 1980s as part of this agenda to dramatically change the makeup of our courts and the makeup of our law to advance this corporate right-wing agenda. So the list that Trump chose from, in essence, was created by the Federal Society, which is this group that includes a number of lawyers across the country, predominantly Republican lawyers. They sort of describe themselves as debating legal ideas, but in reality, what the Federal Society is a feeder system for proving that someone has the right sort of ideological agenda to get promoted to the courts. And the Federal Society has been very active in trying to push the course to the right and in promoting people like Brett Kavanaugh, who have been he says he's not a member, but he's been active in Federal Society events for a long time as representative of their interests. The Federal Society is funded by a number of foundations that are sort of CEO foundations, foundations that are pushing a very corporate agenda through the court, through amicus briefs, through other means, and also, you know, corporations that have been, you know, significant supporters of that agenda through the law firms that represent those corporations. So the Federal Society is not a neutral party. The Federal Society is an actively right-wing entity whose top lieutenant has been put on a leave of absence to go work directly on this nomination. This situation is very different than, for example, the situation that happened when Bill Clinton became president. So when Bill Clinton became president in 1992, he was elected in 1993 and 94. He had two vacancies arise on the Supreme Court. He consulted at length with Orrin Hatch, who was then the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Chairman Hatch discusses this in his book, Square Peg, in which Chairman Hatch said that he recognized that, of course, the president was going to nominate someone who was, you know, didn't have sort of Republican Party credentials, but he wanted to encourage President Clinton to appoint someone who would be more moderate and who would make it through the Senate easily. And Orrin Hatch suggests in that book that the way he sold the nominations to his caucus was that the nominees he recommended were older and wouldn't be on the court for very long. And so he helped recommend Stephen Breyer to the U.S. Supreme Court and Justice Ginsburg, Ruth Bader Ginsburg to the Supreme Court because they were older. They were in their late 50s, early 60s, I think early 60s, and they would likely not be on the court for very long. Meanwhile, the Republicans have tended to nominate people in their early 40s and early 50s to the court. In this day and age, people who are in good health can live, you know, into their 80s or 90s, and some justices do live that long. And so while Hatch had worked with President Clinton to nominate two people who he thought might only stay on the court for 20, 25 years or so, the Republicans have put people who on the court who are much younger and much more ideological. In this instance, with Trump, there wasn't consultation with any of the Democratic senators about who could get through, who would be a consensus choice, who in this closely divided electorate where Trump lost the popular vote by millions in this election, which, you know, I think there's substantial evidence of Russian distortion, Russian influence, to try to defeat Hillary and try to install Trump in power. In the wake of that election, there's zero indication that Trump did any sort of effort to try to identify on a bipartisan basis or on a nonpartisan basis who is well regarded, widely well regarded by Democrats and Republicans alike, who has a reputation for fairness versus being a party operative, a partisan operative, none of that. He instead outsourced this whole operation to the Federal Society. And just this past month, in a spat with Charles Koch over trade policy, Trump basically suggested that he gave the Kochs everything they wanted on the courts. Why are they complaining? In essence, giving over the courts to the Kochs, to sort of the evangelical part of his electorate, the people that he's been trying to appease for votes. Trump, you know, made basically a naked political decision to give our Supreme Court to the right wing to advance the people that they wanted on that court to achieve their agenda. They don't want someone on that court to be fair. The Kochs are interested in having a fair judge, no matter what their rhetoric is about supposedly being devoted to the rule of law. Their vision of the rule of law is that they win, that he with the most gold, it's like the golden rule, he with the most gold rules. So Kavanaugh was chosen.
They haven't even shared the full information and allowed this candidate to be vetted. You know, there are thousands of pages of documents that, you know, were withheld or not shared, or that they're finding reasons to withhold. And so they're really actually giving only, they're not even, there's not even a level playing field for vetting this candidate. And then in this context, suddenly there are these, you know, allegations. And I just want to, you know, kind of make sure we have ample time to kind of explore that, because that's kind of, you know, the current sort of shockaroo. It's like after they had sort of railroaded through, you know, withholding information, this entire man through this process, then suddenly allegations come to light of a alleged sexual assault that he conducted as a minor on a 15-year-old young woman, allegedly, who grows up to be a distinguished doctor and psychologist working with Stanford and, you know, writing and doing original research in scientific journals, who finally, and, you know, has come forward to, you know, an to kind of bring to light this past, you know, inappropriate, you know, attack, which he kind of categorically denies. I mean, how is, you know, if I've misstated that, please correct it to your understanding, but, I mean, how is his posture of denial about this and the wish to kind of cover up who he is, what he's about, you know, so that there cannot be a fair and appropriate assessment. How has that been a theme of these hearings, and how is it now playing out in the effort to rightfully address these allegations?
Well, that's right, Allison, and thank you for getting to that. I'm sorry for the long mm-hmm. context, but you know, this is a situation which is very not normal. You have someone who, in Brett Kavanaugh, who has really been a partisan activist for, you know, much of his career, certainly his early career, and I would say on the bench, he's been a pretty partisan activist as well in terms of his decisions. And this vacancy arose almost just a little over 60 days ago. So this has been moving very rapidly toward a vote by the Republicans in the Senate. His nomination hearing was just in September. That hearing took place even though the National Archives had said it would take a couple more months to pull together all the relevant records about his work in the White House that are part of the Presidential Records Act that should be before the court. But the White House and the Senate Republicans have wanted to rush forward before that record is known to the American people. They move forward that hearing on the week after Labor Day to try to rush it through as fast as possible. Then in the midst of this, to order a vote in committee on that nomination a week after that hearing, even though hundreds of questions were written to Kavanaugh, and some of those answers to those questions arrived only in the evening, right before that vote was scheduled the very next morning. You know, so to try to just to disregard even the importance of his answers in the hearing, to basically have a process where documents that were the most illuminating documents about him lying to the committee, actually, in past hearings, the most illuminating documents were restricted unilaterally by the person who was his former deputy assistant staff secretary when he was the White House staff secretary, is the guy working with the White House to try to restrict access to materials that the senators want. Again, an abnormal, irregular process. Then you have a situation in committee a week ago where the Democrats are asking for subpoenas for some documents to get those documents before the public, and every Republican in a party line vote votes them down. Efforts to give more time to even read the answers, let alone read all the documents that have been provided, let alone the ones that haven't been given. That's voted down. And then you have the initial stories about Dr. Ford, as you point out, and then ultimately over the course of about, 72 hours, she comes forward to share her name and say that she would like to be heard about what happened to her. And she levels a very serious and I think very credible charge against him, against Brett Kavanaugh, that he attempted to rape her when they were in high school. And the Republicans, in the midst of this rush to try to install this man in the Supreme Court, claim that this is the 11th hour. This is some sort of 11th hour deceptive claim to just try to torpedo his nomination. No, it's only the 11th hour because they moved the hands of the clock forward to now in a quest to put this guy in the court before the American people even have a chance to understand who he really is, what his background really means, what his agenda is, both in terms of women's rights, environmental issues, due process, our democracy, and also the power of the presidency and whether a president can be held accountable while he's in office and be subject to subpoenas or prosecution. And so this is this process has been rushed and tried to ram through by these Republicans to get it done before the election.
Well, the latter point that you raise goes directly to the Mueller inquiry and what its actionable aftermath might be. In other words, this could actually interrupt that particular forward movement, getting this guy in. So basically, I mean, from what you're saying, it's really almost, it's like ramming him in, completely ignoring due process, and then putting in place somebody with strong ideological goals that have been dictated to him, a loyalist who's been inside the executive branch, now ostensibly a judge, but coming in with this, allegiance to a particular right-wing perspective that is a very well-funded one. And then it comes down to this matter of who and how, is determining all of this. Absent the allegations of, sexual assault, do you think that this, nomination would have proceeded kind of unstoppably? And if so, or even if not, what are these allegations and the need to address them signaling, and what do they dictate? So that this isn't just about women's reproductive rights, even though it's, women's rights to be protected under the law from assault. It's shaping up as a battle between the needs for representation and rights for women and this particular system of men. But even though the ramifications go all across the entire society, but where does that position the process of this nomination? How has that changed things? Would it have been inevitable before that he be nominated and our hands are tied? Were there other avenues of intervention that now maybe become clearer? Where does this position us in terms of really having the legal precedent or right to do a complete and fair assessment of this man, to do a complete assessment of what occurred, and to really arrive at a fair and honest determination that will be acceptable to the American people about whether this nomination, should go forward?
Well, in terms of the Dr. Ford's statements through her lawyer, I have to say that I was shocked and appalled last night to hear claims being made by the Republicans in the Senate and also by the administration that this is not the type of matter that the FBI would investigate or could investigate or should investigate. The very part of the role of the FBI in these nominations is that they do what's known as a background investigation. That's what it is. It begins with a form SF-86. It's a form that requires a candidate for the bench or for promotion to fill out and disclose all sorts of information about their background, including crimes criminal charges, for example, that occurred from the age of 16 and over. I've read dozens of FBI files when I was at the Justice Department helping to vet nominees. They're, you know, an inch, a couple inches thick. They go through, you know, everyone you worked for, your employer, your college roommate. They talk about in detail your financial history. They investigate it as part of that background investigation by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. What they do is look into your background and whether you can be entrusted, given a position of trust within our government. If someone in that process were to say that the person was a sexual harasser, the FBI would look into that and include interviews with people about those allegations. If someone if an issue had been raised that the person was an abuser, spousal abuser, for example, as with the case of Rob Porter, although I haven't read his FBI background investigation, but if that had been raised in the context of his background investigation, the FBI would have interviewed his spouse or former partners to include in the record for the decision makers that information about whether he can and should be trusted. if this allegation had come forward, if someone had said, you know, I remember something happening in high school where I think he attacked a woman, the FBI would certainly have looked into it, would have interviewed him about it, would have tried to find out who the person was, if anyone was there, and interviewed them. This is what the FBI does as part of the background investigation. The idea that this is closed is absurd. It's not closed. It can be opened. In essence, the file, they quote, opened it to put a letter in there, Dr. Ford's letter. That's not actually what they typically do. They typically would interview Dr. Ford. They would interview the nominee. They would interview any potential witnesses and include those interviews in the record that goes before the United States, is available to the United States Senate. So the idea that this can't be done, that the FBI, quote, doesn't want to do it, according to the Justice Department's young spokesperson asserting that it's not appropriate because the FBI investigation is only for, quote, national security, a complete falsehood on her part, by the way. That's not what its purpose is. Its purpose is to provide to the decision makers information about the full background of a nominee or a person suggested for high office to assess their background and fitness for the role that they are being nominated to. The FBI doesn't make a recommendation as part of that investigation. It provides the factual background. And so it would provide the facts that it ascertained from interviews, from documentary evidence and more that then would be before the Senate. It's completely appropriate for Dr. Ford to request this information. It's completely inappropriate and, in fact, contemptuous of both this survivor, her serious claims, and of women across America to insist on not following that process, to demand that she appear instantaneously for a hearing next week at a time in which she's facing death threats and has had to move out of her home to protect her family while Brett Kavanaugh is ensconced over at the White House imagining various versions of his defense from the posh environs of the White House. This is a manifestly unfair process that the Republicans are trying to put in place. It's a sham of a process as it is to be even before now. And certainly this should not be rushed. A matter of this magnitude, this seriousness, for this court, our highest court, which should have candidates of unblemished records, It should not be rushed.
Yeah, that is 100% the case. I mean, they're trying to portray this as a he said, she said. But then, in effect, through denying the right to an investigation, which would happen in any other, both in this situation and in any other situation, if it was a local level thing, there'd be a local police investigation. Instead, they are setting it up to be a he said, she said. She stands up and, you know, already traumatized, already dislocated, by the attention given this, having to, in effect, defend herself while they play kangaroo court. It just seems like unbelievable that this would be suggested or insisted upon. Do you feel that the American people, that women in particular, are following this and understand the implications of this? Because in effect, the people on the committee have already withheld information. They have, in effect, tipped their hand. How can they serve as both judge and jury in this situation without allowing the FBI to investigate?
Well, I think that the Republicans in the Senate have operated under a might make right set of practices, disregarding rules of the Senate, violating precedents of that committee, the actual terms of the rules of that Judiciary Committee. Now they're asserting things that are simply untrue about the process of the background investigation and how it should be involved, or in their view, not be involved here. They unilaterally dictated that a hearing will occur on Monday. As you point out, there's no rules of evidence in that Judiciary Committee. Grassley, in essence, would be the judge. He's already, repeatedly, basically misconstrued the rules that already govern the committee as it is. It would be, I think, a kangaroo court. The idea that she should be subjected to be treated like he's accused of a crime where he's going to go to jail, and she's got to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he did it, and if he said he didn't do it, everyone's supposed to just believe him, or it's some sort of draw where, like you point out, they want to portray it as a he said, she said, and the default is he gets appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. That's just not justice. No one is entitled to a job on the Supreme Court. It's the rarest of privileges in our entire governmental system to be appointed to the Supreme Court. Surely the Republicans have someone who could be nominated who hasn't been accused of rape, of attempted rape. Surely there are other conservatives who do not have this sort of background, this extreme background, where they have to go out of their way to cover up documents to hide his role. Surely they've got a nominee that they could put forward who hasn't lied to the Senate under oath repeatedly about his background and his role in controversial matters. Surely the court deserves better. The American people deserve better. Proceeding in this fashion and then giving it like an appearance of process is certainly a miscarriage of justice, in essence. And so, I hope that people will be calling, that they'll be calling their friends and neighbors and family members across the country and urging them to call to say, slow down, do not move to a vote, do not force this woman to be re-victimized in this way. Allow the process to proceed. Allow the FBI to do the interview process. Interview Kavanaugh and the other guy who doesn't want to be part of the proceedings, who was there, who wrote a book about his blackout drinking in high school and more. Interview other people who may have been at those parties and find out what those interviews show. Interview her therapist. Look at those notes. Talk to her husband. That should be part of the record before the Senate versus this sort of fictional script that the Republicans have pursued over and over with Kavanaugh, in which they use all this stagecraft to present him as this woman-friendly candidate, with the basketball team or the sport, the young kidsy coaches, and also with some of his clerks, meanwhile obscuring his actual agenda to really dramatically restrict the rights of women in this country. So this isn't about some sort of stage show that the Republicans want to control all appearances. This is about our country, our cause, and the truth. And I hope the truth will prevail here. And I hope that the Senate will not rush forward with this pretense of a hearing next week and short-circuit the background investigation process. And I hope in a normal environment, a normal world, this nomination would be withdrawn. It would not go forward or be insisted upon for a vote under these circumstances. Surely the Republican Party could find someone better without this very serious and serious set of issues that have come out about Brett Kavanaugh.
Mm-hmm. Yes, 100% agreed. You know, you also mentioned that he had part of the record is that he had perjured himself in prior testimony, and this was, you know, we just have a few more minutes, but if you could give us just, you know, maybe a 3 minute on that, because you yourself were directly involved with the content of what he lied about in order to get into his current judicial role, even without going forward to this nomination. And John Nichols of The Nation has suggested, you know, that he should be impeached from his current role based upon this perjury.
Well, I made that call a couple weeks ago, I think around September 7th or 8th. I wrote a piece in Slate magazine after I watched Brett Kavanaugh testify. And my story for Slate, Lisa Graves over there for Slate, says the question shouldn't be whether he should be elevated, but whether he should be impeached. And in that article for Slate, I talked about what he testified to and what the evidence from the email shows, which is that he received materials that were stolen from Democratic staff in what was known at the time in 2003 and 2004 as a digital Watergate, where a Republican staffer had stolen files from Democratic staffers about nominations. Senator Hatch at the time said it was the equivalent of walking into someone's office and taking files right off their desk. Which is, you know, immoral and, was a breach of the Senate's process and practices. At the time that the Senate Sergeant-at-Arms issued a report of his investigation of the theft of those files, that was March of 2004, the very next month, Brett Kavanaugh came before the Senate Judiciary Committee for his first hearing on a nomination to the D.C. Circuit, and he was asked at length about whether he received any files from Miranda, had received any drafts or references to files, documents that might have been created by the Democratic staffers, and he denied it. He said he had never received any such information, and yet the emails that came out this past month showed that he had, including my memos, a talking points research from that I had written. Those were strategic that was strategic research that I prepared for the Democrats. There are other materials that Senator Leahy highlighted in his questioning, confidential letters that were provided, a letter that was provided only to the Democratic Council, that the contents of which was given to Brett Kavanaugh by the person that the Sergeant-at-Arms singled out as the primary culprit of these thefts. So he lied, and I think that that is disqualifying. I think that he should not be promoted to the U.S. Supreme Court, and I think that this matter should be more fully investigated. I think that there should be consequences to him lying to get the seat he now holds on the D.C. Circuit. I think he lied to get that seat, and I think personally he should be impeached. Additionally, this past week on Monday, I co-wrote a piece with my colleagues from the Senate Judiciary Committee in Time magazine. That piece is written by Bob Schiff and Jeff Berman and Christine Lucius and myself, and that piece talks about how Kavanaugh said that it was normal to get this sort of information, this sort of confidential letters from whistleblowers that Manning Miranda is giving to him, this normal part of the normal exchange of information on the committee, And we write in Time about how that's completely false. That is another false statement that he's made. This was battle for the courts, for protect the courts, and Brett Kavanaugh knows it. I think he actively misled the Senate Judiciary Committee, and he actively misled the American people under oath. Why would anyone trust his denials about Dr. Ford with his record of misleading the Congress under oath to get his way?
Yeah, and then there's the additional situation where he served under, clerked for, was mentored by, became a close, almost family-level friend with Judge Alex Kaczynski, who left the courts in disgrace, you know, just a year ago, after a 20-year history of a demonstrated pattern of sexual harassment and of women with, I think, 15 different people who had come forward to validate it, so it's not just one she standing there. And, you know, when questioned this time, Kavanaugh claimed that he was completely unaware of it, and, you know, yet he was right on the scene. So that seems like another questionable statement. In any case, we're coming to the end of our show, and, you know, may true justice prevail, not false justice. Thank you so much for being with us today on Connect the Dots, Lisa Graves. It's been a delight talking to you, and, you know, we'll see how all of this unfolds. Please, everyone, pay attention to this. Let your friends know about it. Call senators and watch for what happens on Monday in the Kavanaugh hearing and going forward.
Thank you.
We'll be back with Connect the Dots next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern on the Progressive Radio Network.
Yeah.